part 4 of 6 from set number 1009, C.G. Jung's Seven Sermons to the Dead, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled The Way Beyond the Stars, Spiritual Wholeness as the Goal of Human Life.
And with that, we'll address ourselves now to the final installment of our discussions on the Seven Sermons to the Dead by Jung, which, as many of you know, of course, over 20 years ago, I had the good fortune, and it was really fortune, because we had no way of predicting that, of having sort of written and published a rather pioneering little work on that subject, which became a sort of little minor classic, the Gnostic Jung and the Seven Sermons to the Dead, and which has been a matter of interest to me ever since, and apparently to some others as well. We certainly don't have the time, and I don't have the inclination, to recapitulate all the earlier sermons, and therefore we'll address ourselves now to the last two sermons, the sixth and the seventh. As I indicated before, the sermons get shorter as they proceed. And the reason for that, conceivably, being that the first, second, third sermon certainly are sort of the attempted descriptions of the indescribable. This is a very common Gnostic tendency, and Jung certainly followed it as much as the great Gnostic writers of the second or the third century. When people have experiences of some sort of the higher, the transcendental realities of being, they usually feel subsequently that it is incumbent upon them to give some kind of expression of that experience, you know. Relatively mundane experiences, personal experiences, don't demand that we express them. In fact, I had a mother who was a very secretive person. Born in the sign of Scorpio, almost exactly a month before my birthday. And she taught me, she said, look, if you want something to remain secret, then you don't tell it to anybody. The only way it's going to be secret, if you don't tell it to anybody. If you even tell it to one person, it's no longer a secret. Well, I think she was right. So, you know, one can do that with certain kinds of experiences if one wishes, and it often is useful, it serves a purpose. The principle of let it all hang out, which is a very unpleasant expression to begin with, it's not my expression, as you know, it's always one that I thought both the very sentence and its supposed meaning is very, very bad. There are many things that should not be made common knowledge for two reasons. Because it won't do you any good, and secondly, because it won't do the people any good whom you tell it. You sort of assume that everybody wants to know about your private and personal experiences. They don't. I assure you, they don't. They are much more interested in telling you perhaps some of theirs than they are in listening to yours. So that is always something that needs to be kept in mind. But when it comes to these very, very powerful archetypal experiences, as Jung would call them, really the experience of the higher worlds, the aeons and so forth, as the Gnostics would call them, that kind of experience comes with an energy that calls for its documentation of some sort. Jung called that kind of activity an assimilation experience. So you had a big experience, and now you have to assimilate it, right? Because if you don't assimilate it, then it's not yours, it doesn't do you any good. And how do you do that? Well, one thing, if you are talking about a literate period of history, and about literate people in history, it's written down. And that is how pretty much all the Gnostic scriptures, for instance, came into existence. But of course there is a problem, that while that compulsion is there to write down the experience, Yet the experience is such a nature that it cannot really be accurately translated into human language. And therefore, it's always a very cryptic, very mysterious, highly symbolic kind of writing that we are confronted with. And the more removed the experience is from human life, the more complex and difficult its description in human language. And that is why the early sermons of the seven sermons to the dead, the first, the second, the third, the fourth, are quite long. I mean, the first one is the longest. Because Jung is trying to describe something there that is indescribable and yet must be described, you know. Such are the paradoxes, really, of the life of the spirit. But the closer we come to our existential sphere of human experience, then the description doesn't become so difficult, and the sermons themselves can be therefore much more brief. And that is what is taking place. So as we come to the sixth sermon, we have a fairly short sermon, and I'll read it to you. These two I will read in full. The sixth sermon, as you will see, it is an elaboration and an application of the fifth sermon. So the themes in it, after a fashion, have been mentioned already in the fifth sermon. The demon of sexuality comes to our soul like a serpent. It is half a human soul and is called thought desire. The demon of spirituality descends into our soul like a white bird. It is half a human soul and is called desire thought. And I said that this was not as cryptic as earlier. Oh dear. The serpent is an earthly soul, half demonic, a spirit, and related to the spirits of the dead. Like the spirits of the dead, the serpent also enters various terrestrial objects. The serpent also induces fear of itself in the hearts of men and enkindles desire in the same. The serpent is of a generally feminine character and seeks forever the company of the dead. It is associated with the dead who are earthbound, who have not found a way by which to cross over to the state of solitude. The serpent is a whore, oh dear, and she consorts with the devil and with evil spirits. She is a tyrant and a tormenting spirit, always tempting people to keep the worst kind of company. The white bird is the semi-heavenly soul of man. It lives with the mother and occasionally descends from the mother's abode. The bird is masculine and is called effective thought. The bird is chaste and solitary, a messenger of the mother. It flies high above the earth. It commands solitude. It brings messages from the distance, from those who have gone before, those who are perfected. It carries our words up to the mother. The mother intercedes and warns, but she has no power over the gods. That is, the lower gods. She is the vehicle of the sun. The serpent descends into the deep, and with her cunning, she either paralyzes or stimulates the phallic demon. The serpent brings up from the deep the very cunning thoughts of the earthly one, thoughts that crawl through all openings and become saturated with desire. Although the serpent does not want to be, she is nevertheless useful to us. The serpent eludes our grasp. We pursue her and she thus shows us the way, which with our limited human wit we could not otherwise find. The dead looked up with contempt and said, "Cease to speak to us about gods, demons, and souls. We have known all of this in essence for a long time." Those dead are really uppity, you know. They talk back and they annoy the poor teacher no end. Thus, we see now that the teacher here is elaborating the theme of sexuality and spirituality which duality appears in the previous or the fifth sermon. And there he said, to remind us of that, he called spirituality with the Latin name Mater Celestis, which translates, of course, the Heavenly Mother. And sexuality he called phallos, which is Greek for the, the male member. And he's called the phallos the earthly father. So the celestial mother, the earthly father. It's interesting to note here that, at least in this particular treatise, the spirit is feminine, the earth is masculine. This is unusual, but only at this particular time in history. And this, of course, as Shakespeare might say, thereby hangs a tale. And I'll tell you, Shakespeare was not opposed to puns, as you notice. And I'll tell you the tale very briefly. When you are dealing with symbology, with symbolic reality, which is a big, big field, you have to be very flexible. Why? Because the symbols themselves are flexible. Symbols are not graven in stone. The other things are. People who bring down tablets from Mount Sinai, or so they say, and with all the do's and the don'ts, or the Sharia of Islam, those things are inflexible. But symbolic reality is very plastic. Not in the sense that it's made out of synthetic chemical material, but in the sense that it changes, it moves. It is also transgressive. When you get past a certain level of, let's say, the experience of the interior realities, everything is a shape changer. Once it looks like this, other time it looks like that. And that can be confusing, particularly when you are only interested in what you perceive. But on the other hand, it can be an inducement to use your intuition to discern what really the keynote, the essence of that symbol is, quite aside from its shape and its appearance. An appearance is an appearance. It appears this way and it can appear that way. That's very important to keep in mind, because people are, very given to fixed and dogmatic attitudes. Not only the fundamentalists, not only the preachers in the pulpit, or heaven forbid on the television screen, although some of them are really, quite cute with those gigantic hairdos and things on that station, the Trinity Broadcasting. It's entertaining, and just no doubt about it. But now when it comes to Pat Robertson and people like that, it's less entertaining. But that's not only those people who are rigid, but the people in the New Age are rigid. The people in the neo-pagan quasi-religious movements and all over the place are very rigid. And one of the rigidities that I think can be unfortunate are these categories, especially with the goddess people. Because it's the goddess, as if they were just one, Any urchin in Athens could have told you that there are many, for heaven's sakes, not just one. But in addition to that, there's always this fixed notion that the goddess has to do with earth. And maybe, if you're lucky, with the moon. But it's always an earth goddess. It is what Jung would call chthonic, because chthonos in Greek means earth. And a number of other characteristics like that. And there is no change. It is always that. Earth is the female, the sky is maybe masculine, and various other rigid categories like that. But if you look at the symbology in the religions, for instance, ancient Egypt, which is after all the source of spiritual and religious symbology for the entire Mediterranean cultures, which, believe it or not, includes Judaism and Christianity and Islam. Then we find, for instance, that the god of earth, very much of a masculine figure, Geb, is certainly not a goddess. And in fact, the Egyptians saw all kind of various protruding objects, including obelisks and so forth, as the erect phallus of Geb, the earth god, sticking up. Incidentally, you know, the Greeks who revered, really, in religious terms, the Egyptians quite a bit, got it a little bit wrong, and they are the ones who changed old Geb into Gaia. And then, of course, it took a bunch of, well, how should we put it, highly imaginative folk in our time to change Gaia into Gaia. You see? But you know what? Gaia was once Geb, the earth god. Up in the sky, on the other hand, was Nut, the god of the night, stretched out over the entire night sky with all the constellations, the stars making up her body. The great lady was up in the sky. You see, now in Gnostic lore also, and certainly Jung was aware of that, the feminine principle is very much connected with the above, with heavens and with the spirit. First of all, the Gnostic Christians, or Christian Gnostics, inevitably called the Holy Spirit she. Holy Spirit was feminine. Attributing to the spirit, was after all, has no gender. It's to pneuma in Greek, which is a neutral gender, has no masculine or feminine gender, a masculine quality, as it came in Latin and then eventually in various other languages, is incorrect. And secondly, of course, there was the figure of the celestial Sophia, who is really the Mater Celestis, the heavenly mother of all of creation. And I can't go into the details of the story, of course. What we have with the divine wisdom, because that is what Sophia means, that she emanates from the ultimate reality and then undergoes various difficulties and various vicissitudes, in the course of which she, just for our purposes here, I'll just say that much, she assumes responsibility for the physical creation and particularly for the human race thereon, and continues to look after them. So here also, celestial being, the divine Sophia, Sophia the wisdom of God, who is revered in the Russian Orthodox Church, certainly the Syrian Orthodox Church, other Orthodox churches also, as a being, not as a quality of mind, but as a being, is also a being who has never been human, has never been in human embodiment, which is one of the reasons that she is always represented in iconography with wings, like an angel, you know. So we have all of these analogues, let's say, in ancient spirituality of the spiritual heavenly mother and of the earthly physical and sexual father. But of course, you see also another thing, that when it comes to the messenger of these two, the bird and the serpent, they switch around. They are of the opposite gender again. So the messenger of the heavenly mother is masculine, and the messenger of the earthly father is feminine. So there are all of these switches. And these are all, at least in part, I think they exist in order for us not to get too fixated on these things like a gender, or to see beyond them. Just because the spiritual worlds are changeable and transgressive and shape-changing, we have to become affinitized to that. Otherwise, we are just another set of dogmatists. So then, here we are with this system. Now, of course, we come to the serpent, and to the principle from whence the serpent is, as it were, inspired, sexuality, commonly called sex. Now, we need to understand Jung's attitude here also, and not primarily in psychoanalytic terms and so forth, because if you do that, then you might say that in Freudian terms, everything is sex. It's just a little bit like that somewhat old joke that has to do with a test that is administered to some students. You know, sort of a, like a word or an image association test, probably. This is one student who writes down to every image which he's supposed to interpret, sex, 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 sex. Well, the professor becomes intrigued by this and calls the student. He says, tell me, my friend, explain to me, how did you come up with that interpretation? The student says, oh, well, doc, you know, it's not really, it doesn't really have to do anything with these images. It just so happens everything reminds me of sex. So, you know, that happens too, and it's a rather Freudian statement. That's kind of the attitude of Freudian psychology. But rather, I think that when we see this, you know, some of the statements that Jung makes about the serpent, we really have a reflection of the Gnostic attitude to sex, which is unlike that of most religions, because it is not regarded as a sinful situation. It is just regarded as something that goes with material life. And like everything that has to do with embodied existence, obviously it will have a shadow as well as a light. It will have a dicey side and a pleasant side. It's just part of life. It's part of embodied existence. And so it is not surrounded by all kinds of mystificatory taboos. On the other hand, we also need to remember that unlike perhaps some archaic primitive religiosity, folk religiosity, the Gnostics did not make a religion of sex. There never was a tantric Gnosticism. The eccentric English magician of the early part of the 20th century, Aleister Crowley, tried to concoct something of that sort, and at times even dared to call it Gnostic. But it comes right down to it. Crowley was full of it, of beans or of sex or whatever, but he was full of it. Now, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I think it bears repeating. How could have Mr. Crowley come up with that conclusion? Well, of course, he was one of those people too. Everything reminded him of sex. There's no doubt about it. But here is what really happened. There are a bunch of people that you heard about who were the heresiologist church fathers. Irenaeus and Eusebius and Tertullian and a whole bunch of them. And these people lived at the time of the Gnostics, and they disliked the Gnostics intensely, and they tried to blacken their name. So what did they do? Any weird and wild and unpleasant and stupid thing that they could think of, they accused the Gnostics of it. And so, among other things, what in some cases what they did, they mentioned some very primitive Egyptian forms of folk magic, which included sexual elements of one kind or the other. And they said, that's what the Gnostics were doing. There's absolutely no proof to that effect. But then someone like Mr. Crowley came along, and since he is so interested in sex, he, like a fly, zeroes in on sugar. He zeroed in on these statements of the church fathers and took them at face value and said that therefore these weird practices are Gnostic. Nonsense. They are not. So here Jung is really dealing with two polarities, which at a higher level are the celestial mother and the earthly father. And when it comes to their messengers, the white bird and the serpent, then he is dealing sort of with the existential impact of these archetypal realities on humans and on human life. You know, Jung differentiated between an archetype as such and an archetypal image. The archetype as such would be what the Gnostics might call an aeonial being, a being that lives in the high aeons. But in order for that to manifest, there has to be an archetypal image. And we might say here that the serpent and the bird are the two archetypal images behind and above which we find the archetype as such, or the archetypal power. So the archetype of spirituality itself at the high level, as we mentioned before, is feminine. But its messenger, the white bird, is masculine, which he names here, among other things, effective thought. Effective thought. In contrast, the serpent is a messenger of the phallos, but itself is feminine. And so we need to keep in mind once again that the feminine-masculine issue of symbolism is made so complex by Jung that it is reduced somewhat to the absurd, and that this is on purpose. This is as it should be, so that people will not get hung up on gender characteristics in a realm of experience where gender characteristics don't belong. One cannot reduce the complex fabric of psychic reality to gross categories such as masculine and feminine dualities. They're much more complex than that. In fact, I would call this pejoratively genderism, which should be just as reprehensible as racism and other isms. Polarities are interwoven, like different colored strands may be interwoven into a complex rope. You know? Now, which one is it? Is it red? Is it blue? I think you have that with some telephone wires, you know? Which one is it? Is it blue? Is it red? Is it yellow? Well, they're all in there. But of course, people who have a kind of very concrete reductionistic mind, it drives them batty. Because they want things to be like this or that. Now, this or that thinking to some extent pertains to our material world, you know? A cat is a cat and not a dog, you know, and so on and so forth. But once you get past this physical realm, even when you're in the realm of dreams, in the realm of psychic reality, there is no this or that. There is this and that, and yet something else, and yet something else. But, you know, it's confusing. People don't like to deal with that, but yet they have to. And when you deal with it insightfully, what does that do? It stimulates your spiritual, your psychological nature. Now I'll say something else that some people are not going to like, but I like to say something now and then that people don't like. You know why? Well, first of all, because I'm mean and nasty myself, you know. It's part of my character. It has always been like that. And a second reason is that it tends to wake you up, you know. You're listening and you grow somnolent. When I say something that bugs you, then you look up. You know, it's a very, very effective way to cultivate wakefulness. Now then, what I intended to say really was that these considerations of not this or that in the higher worlds should not extensively be brought down and applied to this world. Because here, in order to function, we really have to have certain either or propositions. We have to make decisions. We have to make judgments. And for this, we require sometimes a black and white kind of situation. You know? Yes. That's all there is to it. So even as we should not transpose the categories of the manifest physical world into the spiritual world, we should also be very, very careful when we try to transpose the categories of the spiritual world onto the physical world. It's very important to remember that. If we don't recognize that certain things, certain ideas, certain people are not good for us, they're bad, dangerous. Want to call it evil? Call it evil. What do I care? You know, and so forth. If we don't recognize that, then these things are going to hurt us. You heard probably from me, because it's one of my favorites, and therefore I'll tell it again for the M time, of the story from India, wherein a disciple was, you know, studying with his guru, and the guru thought that God is everywhere, everything is God, the great sort of Vedantian oneness, monistic world, and so forth. So the disciples said, oh well, that's great. So he went out, he heard a tremendous commotion, tremendous noise. People were shouting, get out of the way, get off the road, get off the road. The elephant is coming. Well, an elephant had run away and was rampaging, and the driver was still on his back and was shouting, get out of the way, I have no control over the elephant, get out, get out. And this fellow, the disciple, the chela, stood in the road and said, well, he said, I am God, and the elephant is God. So one God can't hurt the other. I'm going to just stay here. Well, the elephant came, ran, and picked him up with his trunk, and picked up the guy and threw him off the road into the bushes, and he got all scratched up and was very unhappy, and he called over back to his guru. And he said, Guru, you said everything is God, and here, I am God, the elephant is God, how could the elephant hurt me? And look, he still threw me off the road. I said, oh yes, but did you listen to the voice of God from the elephant driver who told you to get out of the way? You see? So, you got to pay attention to those things. And we cannot sort of transpose these categories of monism, of beyond good and evil, of everything being good, from up there, where it's quite valid, to down here, where it isn't valid. That's the very difference between the transcendental worlds and these, that in the transcendental realm, good and evil and black and white are transcended, but they are not transcended here. Has to be kept in mind. Otherwise, we can't make any judgments, we can't make any decisions, and we will just be, we won't have any kind of a moral compass. Now, I don't mean to say that the center of your moral compass has to be the law of Moses, or the Sharia, or anything like that, but there has to be a practical recognition as to what is good for you and what isn't good for you. And for your friends, and for your children, and for your family, and so forth. Very important. And so, we come now down to this practical duality. The bird, the white bird, is abstract ideation. It is not non-instinctually determined psychic reality. The kind of things that draw you away from the instinctual, concrete, chtonic sort of earthbound categories of life. It's also, you might say, introversion has something to do with it. Internalization. It is oriented ultimately to the archetypal psyche. That's the story of the white bird. In fact, I might remind us of some of the categories that are stated about it here. It says, the white bird, the semi-heavenly soul of man, because it's here and so it can't be totally heavenly. It lives with the mother and occasionally descends from the mother's abode, called defective thought. It is chaste and solitary, a messenger of the mother. It's up there. It's away from all the dirty life of earth, you know. It flies high above the earth. It's not at all chtonic. It's psychic, it's spiritual, and also mental. That's why it's called effective thought. Not just thought, you know, there's a difference between effective thought and ineffective thought. Most of our thoughts are ineffective. We sit there thinking, and the thinking just leads to what? More thinking. And if you do that, say about, after you went to bed, about, I don't know, about 2 o'clock in the morning, you know what, then they know you're not going to sleep. Because that ineffective thought just keeps on churning out one idea, one thought after the other. It's awful. You have to say, no, come on, get away from me, you know, I want to sleep. That's it. I need sleep more than all of these stupid thoughts that come up, you know. But then there is effective thought, which is the kind of thought that is creative, that leads to something important, you know, that produces an important psychic result. It's effective thought. The bird, it commands solitude. It brings messages from the distance, from those who have gone before, those who are perfected. So this is also of the serpent, he says, the serpent consorts with the dead. While the bird brings messages from those who are perfected. These are two different realms. The realms of the perfected, which in Christian terminology often might be called the realm of the saints. And the other one is purgatorial, and maybe even somewhat infernal, you know. So there is the connection to other beings, and to we don't have to interpret it necessarily in a necromantic manner, that is actually the people who have died. But, you know, there are a lot of forces, there are a lot of ideas, there are a lot of thoughts, there are a lot of impulses that come to us that are really dead. Dead. Not dead. Bad. They don't lead to life. And we have to be able to divorce ourselves from them. While on the other hand, from the perfected realm comes inspiration. And then he says also, it carries our words up to the mother. So the messengership goes both ways. Like the Jacob's ladder on which the angels descend and also ascend. And he says, the mother intercedes and warns, but she has no power against the gods, the lesser gods. What does that mean? Well, isn't that the way the good, the higher, the transcendental, the inspiring generally works? This is both an advantage and a disadvantage here in the world. The good forces, let's put it that way, never force themselves upon anybody or anything. They are there. They are available. Their inspiration is available. Their help is available. If you reach out to them, they reach down to you. But they never force themselves on you. On the other hand, that's not quite true of the less purified and the infernal kind of influences. They try to force themselves. And that's why dictatorship, tyranny, the Stalins, the Mao Zedongs, the Hitlers of this world, you know, it's bad. They have their ideas. The very fact that they feel that it's incumbent upon them to force their ideas, their systems on you, that right there should give you an idea that these people are no good. Because nothing good will tyrannize you. Nothing good will force itself upon you. And you can translate that into contemporary terms. You can look at the Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons and people like that, who are forever trying to force their value system upon others, who are trying to influence legislation and all of that. This, of course, is in an other system. But again, nothing good will do that to you. Nothing good will do that to you. But the good is there. You can reach out to it. But it cannot come down and force things here, because that is contrary to its nature. Contrary to its nature. The true divine is not a tyrant. And that is why the Gnostics were not that happy about a certain graybeard deity in the Old Testament. You see. Because they said, you know, if this God were really a good God, he wouldn't do these things. He wouldn't force himself on people. He wouldn't be so punitive. He wouldn't be so nasty. And, you know, who can really argue with them on that score? One really cannot. So, on the other hand, now we come to the serpent. The serpent is instinctually determined. It moves toward outward objects, sexual or other instinctual objects. Its main thrust is in regard to the satisfaction of the instincts. Now, you have to be a little bit careful here, because instincts, such as the instinct of procreation, the instinct of self-preservation, self-defense, the instinct of nourishment, they take on more complex and sophisticated forms, such as, for instance, greed, which is a big factor. Why does greed exist? Because of two things. We want to be protected, we want security, and we want to have enough. Okay? And to some people, enough is always more and more. You may recall Edward G. Robinson, who was such a forceful representative of whatever opinions he held on the screen, you know, in Key Largo. In Key Largo, he gets mad at his girlfriend, you know, he's a gangster in this gang mall. And he said, I know what you want, I know what you want. You want more, you want more. So, what is money? Money is food, put into a symbolic modality with which you can buy food when things work right. So the more money you have, the more ability the primitive psyche says you have to feed yourself. You're never going to starve if you have all that money. And with that money you also buy houses, you buy big cars, various other things which do what? They protect you. They protect you from the outer world. They protect you from other cars, whatever the case may be. But these all come from the instinctual nature. Instinctual nature, you know. And probably much of the power drive, which Friedrich Nietzsche was so great at recognizing, the will to power, you know, that Alfred Adler took it over from him psychologically, is a modification, an expression of the sexual instinct. Mm-hmm. Dominate, power over other people. So there is the serpent, the serpent. It's instinctual. It crawls around on the ground. It moves with the instincts, and it always, its trust is always outward. How to get hold of money, how to get hold of power, how to get hold of all of these things. It's an extroverted energy. Now, of course, Jung says that even though the serpent doesn't want to, he can still be helpful to us. There are various aspects of that, but I would like to mention from my point of view only one. How is the instinctual nature ultimately helpful to us? Well, from my point of view, in this manner, that as time goes on, and as we follow the serpent around, we hold on to his tail as he goes here and there and everywhere, we find out that all of the satisfactions of our instincts always leave us still unsatisfied. No matter how much you eat, there is a psychic hunger, there is a spiritual hunger that is unsatisfied. Same thing about the other instincts. And so eventually, if you are lucky and if you are very thoughtful, see, this is where self-reflection, self-knowledge comes in. You stand there and you say, you know what? None of these things are really all they are cracked up to be. None of these things give me really what I really want, what I really desire. Oh, they're okay for a while, sure. But what I want, what I need is something else, qualitatively different from the satisfaction of the instincts. Not quantitatively, but qualitatively. And when that point comes, then there is time for the metanoia. Then from going outward, always trying to grab something out there, you turn back. You turn back inward and through your inner being upward. Okay? That is why I am, to the extent that I get interested in those things at all, I'm a capitalist in the sense that I believe in capitalism. I don't have any capital. I never had. You know? Because what happens in the communist, in the socialist, in the fascist system and so forth, where everything is always regulated, is people never really get saturated with the satisfaction of their instinctual nature because everything is forbidden. And of course that happens here too, but at least in a limited degree. That's why I am for the total legalization of drugs. Some people, no doubt, will go downhill and perish, sure. But there will be a few who will say, you know what? I tried this and I tried that and tried the other thing and the other thing. And I found not what I wanted. I have come back from Jerusalem like the dead over here and I have not found what I wanted. But if you don't get what you think will do some trick for you, you don't get enough money. You don't get enough property. Your ambitions cannot be satisfied. You don't get enough of this. Then you're always going to be there gnawing and trying. But when you tried it all, when you had it all, when you've seen it all, then you find out, no, this is not really what I want. There must be something else. Then you find out that there is something else, and then you go to the something else. But as long as the archons of government are there and tell you, no, only so much. You can't have that. You can't have that cigarette. You can't eat so much because you're going to be obese. You know, that's the next crime now on the horizon. You can't eat McDonald's because there's too much fat in it and so forth. Mm-hmm. Then you'll be wanting McDonald's till the cows come home. You'll be wanting the things that they won't let you do. But when you do those things and find out that there is no real ultimate satisfaction in them too, then you'll be able to go on to something else. And this is the reason why as much freedom as possible is the best way to gnosis. So that is an important way in which this instinctually related psychic serpent can actually lead us out of captivity, lead us out of bondage, by finding out that the satisfaction of these ambitions and undertakings and desires does not really satisfy our heart's desire, and that we must find something else. Now then, we got to take a look at the last, and in many ways I think the most beautiful, the most gripping sermon, which is the seventh sermon. At night the dead came back again, and amidst complaining said, "One more thing we must know, because we had forgotten to discuss it. Teach us concerning man," concerning the human. And of course that's an old story, that we inquire into all kinds of things and don't inquire into ourselves. You know, there is another good story about that, which I think also comes from India, that the creator gods, Prajapati and Brahma and all of these fellows in the beginning, they had a great treasure, which is of course the treasure of the spirit. They wanted to hide it, so that their new creation, the human, would take a while finding it. So, where are we going to hide it? One says, let's hide it on top of the mountain. Others say, no, let's hide it in the bowels of the earth. Let's hide it in the water. You know, it goes on and on. Outer space. And then the wisest of the gods said, no, all of those places which you suggested, the human is going to go there and find it in fairly short order. Because he's clever. He will. We hide it right inside of himself. Right deeply within himself, and that will be the last place where he looks for it. the very last place where he looks for it. And so they too, they asked about everything, the dead, but they didn't ask about the human. Now the teacher goes and says, "Man is a portal through which one enters from the outer world of the gods, demons, and souls into the inner world, from the greater world into the smaller world. Small and insignificant is man, one leaves him soon behind, and thus one enters once more into infinite space, into the microcosm, into the inner eternity. In immeasurable distance, there glimmers a solitary star on the highest point of heaven. This is the only God of this lonely one. This is his world, his pleroma, his divinity. In this world, man is Abraxas, who gives birth to and devours his own world. This star is man's God and goal. It is his guiding divinity. In it man finds repose. To it goes the long journey of the soul after death. In it shine all things which otherwise might keep man from the greater world with the brilliance of a great light. To this one, and the one is with the capital, to this one man ought to pray. Such a prayer increases the light of the star. Such a prayer builds a bridge over death. It increases the life of the microcosm. When the outer world grows cold, this star still shines. There is nothing that can separate man from his own God if man can only turn his gaze away from the fiery spectacle of Abraxas. Man here, God there. Weakness and insignificance here, eternal creative power there. Here is but darkness and damp cold. There all is sunshine. Upon hearing this, the dead fell silent, and they rose up like smoke rises over the fire of the shepherd who guards his flock by night. And that is the seventh sermon. I think an important one to look at to begin with, because that is right at the beginning, a little separate from the rest. That the human is a portal through which the macrocosm manifests to the microcosm. The ultimate reality enters manifestation through the human. There is an outer eternity and an inner eternity, and the human stands in the middle. We can go out into a sort of eternity outwardly. You can look at astronomy. It goes on and on, space and so forth, and on and on and on and on and on. But if we go inside, there is another eternity. Right? And it has a little bit to do with that wonderful and slightly culinary metaphor of Alan Watts, that the human is shaped like a donut. Donut has an outer outside and an inner outside. So when you go deeply enough within, you are also beyond yourself. When you lose yourself in outer things, you are also outside of yourself. And then comes the whole rest of the seventh sermon, which has to do with the star. Now, we kind of need to keep in mind the Gnostic metaphor about the star, which I started out my book on Gnosticism with, and which is the notion of the perforated veil. This is metaphorical. I don't think anybody truly imagined it to be literally true. But this was the image of a lot of ancient people, and particularly the Gnostics, that the night sky is like an inverted bowl. We live within it. But it's perforated. Little holes in it. And through those holes, when we look up, which of course are the planets and the stars, the light from a boundless sea of luminosity looks through. So when we look up there, we see the little specks of light which indicate to us that beyond this inverted bowl, which I think Omar Khayyam calls the sky too, there is light, boundless light. And so the star is an opening to another reality, metaphorically. We know what astronomy says about the stars and so forth. That's not the problem. But what we have here is a metaphor that here in the damp, cold, and the dark We look up, there is a point of light. And that point of light is our point of contact with the world of light beyond this world of darkness. And when we meet that point of contact, then hang on to it. Hitch your wagon to a star. Hitch your wagon to the point of contact with the eternal, with the truth. Find it. Because even though there may be myriads of points of light up there, there is one that is yours. And of course I'm talking about the firmament of your soul rather than the external one. Find your point of contact. Keep it in mind. Hang on to it. Because this light will eventually draw you, pull you up into the ultimate great light and luminosity. And ultimately this is really all that matters. And he says that nothing can keep us from our own God if we can only turn our gaze away from the fiery spectacle of Abraxas. Well, the fiery spectacle of Abraxas is the spectacle of the cosmos. The energies that are running wild down here, both in our psyches and elsewhere, and at work for the reconciliation of the opposites and all kinds of other things. Just, you know, if you have ever had a sort of a glimpse of some of these forces, they are titanic, they are incredibly beautiful, they are fierce, but they don't really signify transcendence. They don't. Which is also true of a lot of things in this world. They may be beautiful, they may be exciting, but there's always something there that is dicey, because that's the way this world is. One image that I came up with about that years ago, which was kind of an experience really, beautiful garden, has wonderful view, nice plants in it, really great. And then there is a sort of a part of the garden, there is a little depression down there and kind of dense bushes. If you really look, if you really listen, there's something back there. There is a monster in the garden. There is a monster in the garden. No matter how beautiful the garden is, no matter how exciting, no matter how good a view it has, there is a monster in the garden. And that's true of just about everything in this manifest world. Now, you may think that this is very depressing. But you know what? It's less depressing if you know about it than if you don't know about it and then the monster gets you, you know? Far less depressing. But there is a point of contact with something else. There's a point of contact with the realm of reality that is different. There is no monster in that garden. There is no shadow that light casts. It is, how does Mani put it in one of the Manichaean scriptures? Thou holy undefiled radiance. You see? The holy undefiled radiance. It's different from anything that we recognize here. And the marvelous and the hopeful, the tremendous thing is that there is available to us a point of contact right now. And that's why he says in so many words, and you just heard it, I don't need to repeat it, you know. Recognize that star, hang on to it, don't let go of it, because that will be the one that will take you into the greater light. That is, at our level of comprehension, that is our opening to the other, to the greater, to the true reality, you know. Everything else is explanatory, about the pleroma and about all the various forces and the great dualities. But you know what? What is really important for us is that star. If that star is there, if we can recognize it, if we can remain devoted to it and work with it, that's all that is really required. The rest of it is useful. Because it gives us a framework within which to understand this kind of an experience. It is useful. But that is really the important thing. This is our divinity, and this is our goal. incidentally, as you may see when you are confronted with the text, wherever you may look for it, there is an anagram at the end of the seven sermons. Oh, maybe before I get to the anagram, what do the dead do now? You know, they always argued and they yelled and they remonstrated and all that. And now, like the smoke above the fire, they rise, they float away. And now, there's various ways of looking at that. Maybe one of them being that they are just satisfied now and that they can go their way. But the other one perhaps is that, like in an alchemical operation, they have been volatilized. They are now able to rise. They are able to go up to the star because he had showed it to them that it is there. And now they are going. They don't talk anymore. Of course, they don't say any thank you either. You didn't expect that out of that bunch of rascals. Right? But they are going. So my feeling is that they have, in the end, they sort of got the point. And now they have been changed and they are rising and they are moving. Jung said, as I have indicated earlier on, that this scripture, along with some other things in the Red Book also, was really the backbone of all of his subsequent work. These initial insights gave him the inspiration and gave him actually the content, the structure of the content for all of his later work. And therefore, I think it's of considerable importance, of considerable significance for us. But if you ask me, you know, which part of all of these sermons, of all of the various interesting, intriguing prophetic statements, which is the most important? It is the seventh sermon. Because that is our existential reality. That is where we are. In the dark, underneath the bowl, and yet able to perceive the light. And not only perceive it, but by perceiving it, knowing what it is and move toward it. And as we move toward it, then all other things really will take care of themselves. That is the way it has always been. And so I'll conclude with a stanza from a poem by the mystical poet of the turn of the last century, not this last one, but from the 19th to the 28th A.E., which I concluded the prologue to my book on Jung, the Gnostic Jung and the Seven Sermons with. Out of a timeless world, shadows fall upon time. From a beauty older than earth, a ladder the soul may climb. I climb by the phantom stair to a whiteness older than time. May we climb, and may our climbing yield a time and an occasion when the climbing, when the journey is over, and when we have arrived, and when we are home. May that day come soon. Thank you.
Copyright MMB by BC Recordings. Catalog number 100904. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.